Welcome back to Why I Am a Christian, or Why I Am Still a Christian. This is part four. The first three, I largely spent time just talking about my starting point and kind of growing up in the sort of Christian household and context I was in. And I think it was important for me to describe my headspace in the way I think about things and how I care about things deeply philosophically. And how I got more and more of a sensitivity to explaining things away. That was this growing feeling that I couldn't just explain things away. I couldn't just read an article online to, you know, help rationalize how there could have been a global flood and then feel better, which is what I would do maybe in high school or something. That got harder and harder to do, especially as, you know, as you get older, you see that sort of process happening for things you don't believe in, and it repulses you. You know, like you, the last thing you want to do is do that with your own beliefs, ultimately, even though plenty of people do. So that was kind of my starting headspace. And I just wanted to seek truth in all areas of life more and more. That became a top priority for me in all areas of life, that truth, really almost to a too severe degree, but truth was the most important thing, because like, how could you even have real love without truth? Because first you need to be able to clearly understand or see the thing or person that you love. If that's a lie, then can you even call that love? So truth is just fundamental, because we need to be able to reflect reality back into our heads to make any progress in any direction with anything we care about. So I just, yeah, became obsessed with that. And almost, like I said, almost to a too severe degree. I mean, it definitely contributed to why I have some OCD now. I've heard OCD called the doubting disease. And man, did I encourage doubt in my own life, like very intentionally. And I probably went a little too far with that. But anyway, that was sort of my starting headspace. And where I left off last time was that I was in college, towards the end of college. And what sort of sparked some questioning was I was getting towards the end of college, maybe had a little more free time in a sense then, or just like, you know, thinking ahead about what comes after college and everything. And one thing that sparked a lot of the initial questioning, or I guess the thing at that time, was questions about my own salvation, essentially, just about those tricky verses in Hebrews 6, I believe, about losing your salvation, which was always scary. And I could just tell I still had this mindset of sort of patching things up to feel comfortable so I could move on. And I knew I just couldn't keep doing that anymore. Like, that just doesn't hold water as you get older and more mature, and it can't sustain something for a long time. You can't convince yourself too much. And so first it was kind of like, I need to dig in on this specific thing about like salvation. But then that just spiraled into, is this all true? You know, how do I know it's true? And I can't just try to subsist on my childhood faith, kind of. And I mean, that's a little bit reductive to say, because I had read many, you know, deep Christian books as I grew up, and I didn't truly just have a childhood faith. But I mean that as far as like some of these key questions about the truth of it all, perhaps, that I just hadn't dug enough, you know. And like I said in a previous episode, I dug more into some specific things about like evolution and creationism and all that sort of stuff, and I was very, you know, disappointed with that. I felt like I kept losing those battles, and I couldn't figure out why, you know. So but yeah, so this just made me want to pull off the band-aid more, face my fears, kind of. One thing I'll note is, and I only thought about this as I got deeper into the questioning, but you have to almost take this leap of faith, and I mean it in a very different way than other. I'm not talking other people. I'm not talking about leap of faith to Christianity. I'm talking about leap of faith that questioning is the right thing to do, because there is this fear of what if, especially if you're, you know, you're an anxious person anyway, There's this fear of what if I question and I'm basically deceived by the other side and I'm like yanked out of Christianity and then I'm going to go to hell, basically. And that's especially if you have a traditional view of hell as eternal conscious torment, which is the worst thing possible to imagine, literally. Especially if you have that view of hell, it's almost like if you do the probability calculus of like expected outcome, it's almost like it can almost convince you that questioning isn't worth it, because what if you're wrong? Basically, I didn't even mean to talk about this, but like I'm coming to this weird twisted version. I'm not saying I approve of this of Pascal's wager. So like you basically have to have this leap of faith that questioning is the right thing to do. And I mean, it doesn't ultimately have to be a leap, because if you work it out, you think, well, if Christianity is not true, I mean, another religion could be true. And then I need to first leave Christianity to then go find the truth. Or obviously, if you know, atheism is true, then that's the better life, too. Like, in the end, common sense is going to take over, hopefully, and tell you you just need to question if you need to question. You need to know the truth. Like my mom said, I mentioned in a previous episode of where she said, you know, Robert, you need to believe it's true. Like you can't, you know, convince yourself. But it does feel like in the moment, this leap of faith, because my mind is telling me, what if, you know, I'm allowing myself to be deceived and then I go get tortured forever, you know? And you could use all of what I just said as an argument against religion, and I brought this up in a previous episode, but I want to point out that this has to do with a certain religious mindset that might be based on false premises that are not even Christian, you know, about eternal hell and all that, which I don't believe in eternal hell, which I'm going to get to in a second. So I don't think it's fair to use that against a religious mindset. I think it still needs to be addressed, and so I don't want to sweep it under the rug either, but I don't think that line of reasoning I just went through about fear of questioning, I don't think that's even a properly Christian attitude to be afraid like that. I mean, doubting Thomas wasn't reprimanded by Jesus for doubting anyway. So I was thinking about my salvation or whatever. So I start studying those verses, and then, yeah, I just kind of start peeling the Band-Aid off. And I remember one day I just immediately Googled two things that had bothered me for a long time and that I maybe halfway avoided looking into. One, I definitely was worried about looking into. And the first one is kind of funny. I don't know how many people will relate to this, but it was, is God arrogant, was my question. And I am very sensitive to arrogance, like more than most people. I mean, no one likes arrogance, but like I think I'm especially sensitive. And I've also always tried to root it out of myself. However successfully I've been, I don't know, but I'm very sensitive about that, and I have heard skeptics talk about this, you know, like God is always asking for glory, and especially like the Old Testament God, you know, and that really bothered me. Like, that's not, you know, the conception of an ideal, humble, lovely person, you know. And it's funny, I actually got a really good answer to that. In my opinion, which is, you have to think of God, well, if God is love, which is what, you know, the Christian, Orthodox Christianity says, and God is not just love, but the locus of all good things, that God saying, worship me, is literally God saying, set your eyes and your goals and your whole focus of your life and being on love, justice, goodness, you know, all those things, charity, whatever. And those things are located in me, God. So, yeah, that just, for me, that just solved that logical question of like, God pointing us at himself is not an ego thing. It's God pointing us at goodness, where they're at the only place there is goodness, which is God. So, I mean, I'm sure you could dig more into that and debate it or whatever, but it was encouraging, because I was like, I never thought of it quite like that. And it immediately, you know, made sense. And I mean, it's just important to recognize that God is the supreme being, and the normal rules about personality, ego, like anyway, we probably shouldn't think about it the exact same way. But like that, yeah, getting that specific answer really helped. Second thing was, in fact, about hell. Yeah, the idea of eternal conscious torment had always, I mean, it's like the most deeply, like I said, deeply unsettling thought you can have, really. Especially, and I think I brought this up in a previous episode, especially paired with double predestination or hyper-Calvinism, to where, you know, you're arbitrarily, what it seems like is you're arbitrarily sorted into sheeps and goats, and the goats go to hell, and hell is eternal conscious torment. And the goats really didn't have any control over that because they're predestined. I mean, yeah, we don't need to dwell on that. But I Googled that, and once again, I actually got an immediate good answer, which is I discovered for myself annihilationism, which I never even heard of at that point, I don't think. And annihilationism is the doctrine, the belief that instead of being tormented forever, the people that are not redeemed will eventually cease to exist. I'm not trying to make this a whole podcast about theories of hell, but and you can debate, you know, the morality of even that, of ceasing to exist, but like you can agree that that's way better, seems way more ethical than arbitrarily, what seems arbitrary, you know, just torturing someone for eternity. And I mean, to this day, I think you can make a much better biblical and philosophical case for annihilationism than eternal conscious torment. So those two questions I immediately got pretty good answers to. And they didn't feel like they were patching things up that were rationalizations. And it's, I guess it's important to note that some of this stuff about is it a rationalization or not, you can only sort of judge for yourself. I recognize that, or you basically you can judge for yourself, or you have to get into a very long detailed debate about why something is probable on the whole when you add it all up together, or why it's not probable and it's a rationalization. I mean, that's just a tricky thing to do. So I'm having to, you know, use shortcuts in this discussion, and maybe I'll do future videos on some of this stuff. Yeah, that all I can say is I felt like I had become extremely sensitive to rationalizations, and I developed a pretty good nose for it, where I could smell those rationalizations. It seemed, and these two didn't seem like rationalizations to me. Were they perfect solutions that absolutely answered the question without any possible, retort? No, of course not. But like, they seem like not only good answers, but probably more likely than the alternative, or maybe even a lot more likely. So that was helpful. And then what really happened is, I'm sorry, I'm looking at my notes a little bit because this is where it gets complicated. This is basically the start of a multi-year period of really just getting into the weeds, and then ultimately a 10 or 15-year period of different areas of study. But those first few years were the most intense. I think the next thing that kind of happened is, I believe I randomly bought a William Lane Craig book. I didn't know who he was. I don't know what led me to buy this book. I don't think I was given it, but it was Hard Questions, Real Answers, I think is the name of the book. And I don't know which question I was Googling at that time or whatever, but I really liked that book. And it was just very different than sort of pastoral patch-up jobs of the past, for hard questions. It felt like he was facing the questions head on and giving solidly decent answers to them. And eventually that led me, of course, for anyone who is in the space of Christianity and skepticism, of course, you know about William Lane Craig. And for those who don't, he's probably the most well-known Christian apologist out there. He's a professional philosopher. He is a respected philosopher. Like, you will hear well-known atheist philosophers give William Lane Craig his due. Now they, vehemently disagree with him, and I'm sure think he, really exaggerates certain things or whatever. But like, he is no hack job. He's legit. He's made significant contributions to the philosophy of time, His doctoral thesis on what's called the Kalam cosmological argument has been called the most discussed argument for God, in like, since it was written, and that was back in like the 60s when he wrote it. So he's the real deal. Even if obviously you have to decide for yourself, if he's actually right or wrong, of course. So of course that's what, hooked me. Like that came through in his book. So he is also a well-known debater, and he's a good debater. He's not just smart, and I would say has good arguments, but he's also just a proficient debater itself. Like I believe he was like a debate team champion and stuff. And so he's well known for winning almost all of his debates. And part of that absolutely is because he's a better debater, but I think he also has solid arguments. So I got That was maybe one of the first big steps to just this completely breaking open, was just watching all those debates. And over the years, I have now watched every single debate that is online of his, which is, I think there's at least 50 or so. So I've probably watched over 100 hours or even 150 hours of him giving his, side of the debate, but also, 150 hours of various skeptics pushing back and giving their best attack on Christianity. And yeah, I brought up debate in an earlier episode, but I fell in love with debate because I felt like it was, if they were quality debaters and top people in their field, they're way less likely to get away with BS than if I just read one of their books, because the other side is right there to call them on it. And so I felt like they were making more humble arguments, arguments that were more robust because they're doing it in front of a public audience with an opponent. And so I fell in love with debates, and debates are far from perfect. And some of these topics you do have to read whole books on. But it became a really helpful heuristic to figure out where the actual debate topics, where the hot topics were that really needed to dig, that I needed to dig further on. So that was really helpful. And I think what happened here, probably the next thing to talk about, is inerrancy was, a thorn in my flesh, because everything with creationism. So like, I gotten to a point where first I let go of the age of the earth. I knew it could be old, but I also knew that could probably be reconciled with the Old Testament. Then evolution was kind of next, and that was harder to reconcile with like the Old Testament, but felt doable. But then just this overall feeling of the Bible having to be perfect just started to weigh heavier and heavier. And this came from becoming more mature, and I think just like my epistemology and stuff too, that I realized that you can explain away a verse here and there, but you can't explain away everything. The probabilities get too large at that point. Like the Bible is a long book, and it has so many different stories and so many places where it intersects with known history. And there's so many points, there probably is at least one of them where there's a seeming discrepancy that is resolvable, just based on probabilities. Like the world is a big place, and all these dice rolls are happening all the time, and weird things happen that there's an actual resolution to once you hear all sides of the story, right? So it makes sense that there'd be at least, some of those that could be resolved in the Bible, discrepancies. But not all of them. Like if it would come, the probabilities come when you combine them together, multiply them together. And if you have a, a severe view of inerrancy, then all the probabilities have to come out a certain way. And it just becomes, in my opinion, untenable. Greg Boyd says that inerrancy dies the death of a thousand qualifications, and that's how I feel. Basically, when I would talk to more learned and scholarly Christians who were even, on the conservative side, they just made inerrancy more and more vague and had all these qualifications to the point where I had to let that go. But that's sort of jumping ahead a little bit, because I didn't know what to do with inerrancy, because I'll probably end on this point because I'm getting close to 20 minutes. It goes so fast. But basically, yeah, at this point, to go back to where I was in my journey, I wasn't sure what to do in the IRC, and it still really bothered me, those discrepancies and issues. And some of them seem key. And even if they weren't key, doesn't Jesus teach that the Bible is perfect, you know, is God's words and stuff, word and stuff. And therefore, if it's not perfect, then Jesus was wrong and Christianity seems to fall apart, right? So, one thing that helped me actually was a question of the week that William Lane Craig posted on his website, Reasonable Faith. And he said that basically he made this really great argument that we have more evidence, historical evidence, for Jesus rising from the dead. And that is a huge topic, which I'll talk about some next time. But we have more historical evidence for that than we do that Jesus taught the Bible had to be absolutely perfect. So if those come into conflict, the belief that we jettison is that the Bible is perfect, that Jesus thought the Bible was perfect, because we have less historical data supporting that. And so that helped me unhitch inerrancy from Christianity being true, because now that wasn't necessary. Now, it still really bothered me, because if it seemed like Jesus taught the Bible is perfect, then that's still a big problem. But it did help me put it to the side a little bit. And so basically, I think there's kind of two broad things going on during this period for me. One was just like an overall survey of all of the arguments for and against God. So all the philosophical ones, the cosmological ones, the moral argument, all those sayings. Miracles came later. That didn't come up in debates as much. I got more into that later. But yeah, so a kind of general survey of the arguments for and against God's existence I was getting familiar with, and then boiling it down to what seemed to matter the most. And it seemed like a linchpin was Jesus's resurrection, because that one's hard to get around. Like, if that didn't happen, then what are we even believing in? So yeah, I'll dig into that more next week. It'll probably be next week before I post the next one. And yeah, I'll leave it there. Thanks so much for listening.